For the last session in our series on Latin American psalmody, today we will be talking about friends and enemies in the Psalms, in the Old Testament and in the Latin American Psalms. I'm Erhard Gerstenberger, as you know, or might know, from previous encounters. Well, let me first point out a few things about literature which you might want to consult on this on these matters which we touched upon. I discovered a comprehensive book on Latin American situations from the economic situation to the spiritual situation, that is by Esther and Mortimer Arias, The Cry of My People. That seems to be an introduction to the Latin American liberation theology and its background from the viewpoint of a couple who has been working there in Latin America. I'll give it along and so you may have a look, as well as the other books. The name of Helder Kamara was mentioned many times, you know, and there are some translations of his works in the bookstore and in the library. Helder Kamara, the Bishop of Recife. And the other book I haven't with me, but I mentioned it before, is of Pedro Casaldáliga, a diary, very, very good diary. Pedro Casaldáliga, I Believe in Justice and Hope is the title. That's in the bookstore, I saw it, in the bookstore, probably also in the library. Well, these three I would like to mention, and if you want to look more on the Psalms, you may consult my commentary, which I had with me the other day. I gave it to the library, it's now in the library. And the first introduction, page 5 to 22, gives you an idea of how I look at the Psalms, of the different Psalms, also of those on those Psalms which we did not touch here. There is an article which I wrote in Word and Word, the Lutheran periodical, in 85. I didn't find the number here in Holden. It's 85, volume fascicle 2, with the title Singing a New Song in Latin America, which also tweets with this thing. And here's another periodical issued by Pittsburgh. I wrote an article in this, Enemies and Evildoers in the Psalms. I'll let you know, see it. So this is the topic of today. So, but we want to begin, I believe, with our song, our brief hymn, Portuguese hymn, which we did not manage to learn yesterday. because the time was so surprisingly fast spent, you know, that I'm sorry that we can get into it. I've put the words up there, Cantai ao Senhor um cântico novo. That's the beginning of Psalm 98, verse 1. And the Brazilian communities made it into a new hymn. Perhaps you know what it means from looking at it. Cantai means sing. It's the imperative. Sing, you, fox, sing. Cantai ao Senhor, to the Lord. Sing to the Lord. Um cântico novo, that means a new song. Well, you know it already. You know Portuguese. Wonderful. So you learn the second little hymn, a Portuguese hymn in this week. Cantai ao Senhor um cântico novo. This will be repeated several times, but the words are there. Let's speak the words first. Cantai ao Senhor um cântico novo. 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 The pronunciation is a little bit different, and sometimes, you know, especially difficult for us is the nasalization of the um, but you can practice this at home still. Cantai ao Senhor um cântico novo, cantai ao Senhor um cântico novo, cantai ao Senhor um cântico novo, cantai ao Senhor, cantai ao Senhor. That's about it. I'm not a good singer. I should ask you to sing it for us.
I mean, you wouldn't But you may help us now to intone it, okay? You heard it, and I guess you are able to pick it up very quickly, more quickly than we do.
Cantai au Señor, un cantigo novo, cantai au Señor, un cantigo novo, cantai au Señor, un cantigo novo, cantai au Señor, cantai au Señor.
That's what the end was a little bit different, I think. You picked it up different. Once more, and then we are all set. That's our new hymn. That's a hymn of praise, Psalm 98, verse 1. And the hymn really goes on. We don't have time to sing it all. Once more, and then.
Cantai au Señor, un cantigo novo, cantai au Señor, un cantigo novo, cantai au Señor, un cantigo novo, cantai au Señor, cantai au Señor.
You got it better now, I guess. And at the end, I hope we can repeat it, and then you are all set. First of all, our one psalm came in, one more besides those which we already had. We have been collecting our own psalm compositions for those who haven't been here before, and I'm trying to read it. Lord, whisper in my ear the truth I should hear. Amid the blaring of the televisions and radios and the awful pounding beat of machines and automobiles around me, show me that small exquisite spot of beauty you have hidden among the giant billboards and glaring neon lights which the world would have me watch. Let me cling to those essential and basic truths which will sustain me and carry me through the tempting lies of our age, which would keep me from seeing the wrongs we are doing in your name and in the name of progress. Give me wonder and joy and faith to celebrate the gifts you have given me to use. May they glorify your name until I am home in your secure embrace forever. Are there any more texts you wrote last night between sauna and going to bed, or or before? Well then, that's the harvest for the time being, and I will give it to our friend here who has offered to type these texts up and make them available to whoever wants them. The list is going around with your addresses, okay? Thank you very much. So, today, I tried to pick up one or two points from yesterday's session and continue to point then to focus. I want to continue to focus on our special theme for today, friends and enemies. And I hope this time I won't talk so much as I did yesterday, and let you talk more and enter into the discussion about the Psalms. I think that's essential. We didn't get around to ask ourselves what the hymn of praise really does to the community which sings it. Before we do that, I want to point out one more fact which we take from the Bible and which continues into our own history. Praises, we said, have been sung all along by Jews and Christians into our time in the midst of misery even death. There is a beautiful story in the book of Daniel when three young men who refuse to adore the idols of their time, which are set before them, and who hear very well the command of the king, of the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, fall down and adore the gods which I have put before you. And this is so beautifully told in a mythical, in a beautiful, truthful language, you know, which is true until our days. Go and bow down. Adore my idols. We hear this every time. If we watch out for these words, you know, bow down and adore the idols of your time. We have many idols. We have been hearing about them. And these three refuse and are thrown into the, how would you call that, the big oven, you know, the holocaust, into the chamber of to be burnt.
Furnace.
That's right. Into the furnace, into the hot, overheated furnace. And there they are, and they walk around, they are bound and thrown into it, and people who can see through a little hole what they are doing, they observe that their enemies are watching them. You know, they are walking freely in the glowing coals and in the heat, and they are singing praise. Well, this last thing does not occur, this affirmation that they sing praises, yet in Daniel 3, you may read it at home, Daniel chapter 3, it says only that they are going unharmed and unhurt, they are moving in the fire, which is of course a better truth than in any documentary and historical truth, you know, it's much deeper. They are moving around and they get out unhurt, and the Babylonian king is very much frightened to see that God had helped them to go through hell like this. There are some more observations in this chapter. I want to point out that in the subsequent tradition of this chapter, tradition kept working on this story of the three young men in the hot furnace, and in the apocryphal. Parts of the Bible, there soon was added a song which had been sung by these three men inside the fire, and it was a song of praise. This demonstrates that the tradition knows that people in the Jewish faith, or speaking about these only, have been able to sing God's praises even in death and in destruction. And I want to remind you, and this hurts me as a German particularly, that there have been Jews walking into the gas chambers singing hymns sometimes. This is terrible to say, you know, in retrospective, and even to draw some comfort from it, but it's terrible to say, but I think I want to mention it. This is in the line of this tradition that people have been able to sing praises in the midst of death. And this is also true for the Brazilian Psalms. I quoted the man who was being executed or was sentenced to death and knew that he was being executed. I mentioned and cited it in the first session. He wrote a letter of comfort to his son: "Tomorrow, my son, everything will be changed." And although he knew that he was going to die on the next day. You see, that's what I mean. Praise is not only an expression of faith in an exuberant mood of joy when we see the mountains. We can sing out and say, "How great is God who created all this here around us!" You know, the peaks and the rivers and the trees and the animals and everything. This is also an occasion to sing praises, certainly. But praise belongs also into lament psalms, into the situations of death and destruction and persecution. Why? And this is one question I wanted to raise now, still, you know, in subsequence to what we said yesterday. Why is it necessary to sing praises in these awful moments of death, where nobody knows yet that salvation is near, or that the thing will end in a peaceful and harmonious way? You know, the Jews in front of the gas chambers, they knew that they didn't have a chance to escape, and they sang praises. You know, you might talk about your own reflections on this at this point. I would maintain what I had said before. Singing praises is something like asserting your own foundation of faith. It's not dependent on the successful and good exit of things. It's something like asserting your own identity, your own community. It creates community. It protects and saves community. It creates life in the midst of death, although the destruction is overwhelming us, possibly. And I think there is this other point, which you may have heard before. We talked a little bit, which is so difficult for us to accept. To sing praise to the Lord is also to strengthen God. We have one psalm in the Psalter which says this very clearly. It's Psalm 29. And there the whole creation and even the defeated deities of other people, the minor deities and demons, are exhorted to say, to bring praises to the Lord. To bring praises. Should we... Oh, I forgot to bring the English Bible. But somebody might read one or two phrases of this. Bring praises to the Lord. And this means strengthen the Lord of hosts, who is above all. You singing praises, you community singing praises, you also strengthen God. That's an unusual thought. We usually don't know it, but it's in there. It's in the Psalter. And I want you to reflect on it. Yes.
Those of you who are Lutheran may recall that in an article in the Lutheran magazine some 3-4 issues ago, Bishop Wenis from the Grand Canyon Synod in Arizona, at least, I'm not sure of the name of the synod at the moment, wrote an article in which he said we ought to have our funerals on Sunday, right in the middle of the service. Mm-hmm. He said, what's the reason to hide a funeral on Tuesday morning when nobody can get off work? You know, that the funeral is a time of joy, really, because the culmination is what we're all looking for. So why should we have funerals hidden away on Thursday morning or Tuesday morning? I just thought I'd mention that. It was a kind of a refreshing point of view. So the sadness, which we all have to, which we expect and we know it's going to happen, but there's joy and praise associated with it.
Wonderful. This reminds me of my pastorate in Essen in Germany. Whenever I could agree with the relatives of the deceased, you know, I let them or had us sing Easter hymns, one Easter hymn at the funeral. That's the same thing. You know, the victory in spite of death, you know. I think that's a good comment. And one more little... yes. Please.
Personal reflection, when my wife was diagnosed as having terminal cancer, the thing that kept me going was hymns.
Oh, wonderful.
Children of the Heavenly Father, Christ is risen.
Yes.
And a lot of the Bach music.
Yes.
And I like Bach. Uh-huh. And the words became more and more meaningful, especially that one, am I right? The Austrian National Anthem is one of our hymns we have the music for.
Yes.
Line about if I am a member of Zion M, that line there became more, the closer the death came, mm-hmm. the more important that line became.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And afterwards, just a sidelight, I went up, they had a memorial service at a former mm-hmm. parish, and I went mm-hmm. there, a good Jewish friend, just mm-hmm. a real good friend, and they asked me what I thought about my wife's death, and I told them, I said, well, he says, after watching what's going on, she's got to be better off than what she was.
Mm-hmm.
Anything I believe about heaven is true, then she's got to be better off. And mm-hmm. afterwards, he put his arm around me, he said, he said, you roll me over with how strong your faith is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And? I said, I don't think it's so strong.
Yes.
sure I can say that, but he said, well, it is to me. It's really a power.
I am impressed by the Brazilian base communities who are not strong. You know, they lack every kind of power, but they are strong in this kind of faith, asserting the presence of God, the victory over of life over death, in spite of all the moments and all the facts which speak against this. You know, that's irritates me sometimes.
Yeah, it seems like the question that you raised that we're mm-hmm. discussing. We can't make God any stronger, but we can make our belief in God stronger, and mm-hmm. that can help us to live through all the oppression mm-hmm. and the difficulties.
Yes.
And I think people who have hardship come a lot closer to God.
Yes.
Than people who just sort of get through without a huge dose of hardships.
Yes. Yes.
Although everybody has their small problems, and some mm-hmm. avoid dealing mm-hmm. with them.
Fine. But I would really like to talk about this point and say what does it mean? You know, in the Bible I see that this Psalm 29. Did anybody find a verse to that effect? Bring praises to the Lord, strengthen the Lord. You know, that's maybe very close to each other. You know, this kind of strengthening your own faith and strengthening God. There is a mutuality about this. You know, interconnection. You know, God is strong in us, perhaps.
Well,
however we can name it.
Is it not possible that we have made God some kind of a weak sister, that we're for a weak brother, that we're afraid we need to tell the way we feel? We get into the glamour of the whole thing rather than saying, right now I'm mad as hell at you, and I want to know why you're dumping on me.
Yes.
Up on somebody else. Leave me alone for a while. I got enough of you.
Uh-huh.
But we don't do that. We don't do that. And the thing that brings this up is I had a couple of Pentecostal churches that were praying, and one of the pastors told me, your wife is going to be healed. And I thought, you're out mm-hmm. of the tree. But he kept his prayers going, and she was healed. Mm-hmm. Death is healing. And that's for her, mm-hmm. death was a healing.
Yes.
But they were praying for a physical healing. Disease would stop, and the more they prayed, the worse the disease got.
Yes.
I was saying, sleep my office one day, and I said to my associate, I said, I wish they'd shut up on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Go pray at somebody else,
mm-hmm.
because it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need it. I got enough false hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came right back and said, well, God's in charge anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to, I don't think that we understand what we say when we say God is in charge. Do it all.
I think so.
And even with the Brazilians, they trust this God to do it all.
Yes, and they trust also to be part of this doing of God. I now have the verses here, 29, the first two verses. They really say, I can read it in German, I haven't in English right now, bring to the Lord, or translate it, you heavenly hosts, bring to the Lord honor and strength. I don't know how it's expressed in English. Honor and strength. Bring, and every kind of praise is strengthening the one who is praised. I was reminded of this yesterday when you sang or the other group sang, and how I pleaded this before with you. Think of God in a human way. You know, think it think of God as much as possible in human terms, from our own experiences. God will not be offended. Only our theologians will be offended when we think of God in we theologians, you know, in a human way. When I heard your choir sing, and there was immediately an exchange occurring between choir and audience, and you know what we sometimes say, they heat each other up, you know, and the applause makes the choir sing stronger and more faithfully and more joyfully, and you could observe this kind of interchange. That's for me a picture of what is going on when we praise God. When we applaud and participate, the other side will get stronger, you know, so there is a mutual strengthening. Does anybody have the words in English? Glory and strength, it says. I translate honor and strength. Okay, glory and strength. And that's a kind of heavenly occurrence. Psalm 19 also speaks about the heavens singing the praises of God. I like these very human understandings of God in a very human way. I like them, and I think they are telling. I like the low key theology, you know, which comes out of our experience and is able to well knowing that we never grasp God, as you said, you know, we never understand Him, but we are pardoned and we are liberated to use these images over against God. I think to understand some of Him, of His power and His strength and beauty. Yes, please.
Also, God has a supporting cast. There are multitudes of angels and saints.
Yes.
And they all get real happy when one sinner returns.
Yes, yes.
So there must be joy up there all the time.
The resounding, you know. Yeah. And I remind you of the little things we talked about yesterday, of the little blade of grass, you know. And this brings me to another point. It's the ability to sing praises, which is so easily forgotten in well-to-do situations, which is so remarkably much more alive in oppressed situations and in situations where people find themselves unable and marginalized and handicapped and so on. I can tell you stories about people who had suffered some kind of limitation, physical or mental or something, and who were able to see the world in a different light. They saw the beauty of the world and God, and they saw it in small things, like we said yesterday. And this provokes hymns, you know. Let me just mention this example, which is always on my mind. I visited once a young woman, about 20 years of age, who had been suffered this children's paralysis, polio, and she was virtually paralyzed to her neck. She could move her head, nothing more. And I was so afraid to make this pastoral call to this woman. And when I came there, she was a friendly and radiant person who inquired about my doings and was interested in everything, and radiated so much confidence, so much hope, so much joy, you know, that I went away strengthened. Really, and I've met more people like that, and this strikes me as a pastor or as a Christian, how this is possible. You know, this is in one of the former sessions I said it's one of the miracles of God that the poor people in Brazil are able to sing. You know, one of my strongest impressions in Brazil, they sing praises in their communities. How can they, under all their living bad living conditions? Awful. And somebody said of the audience said, well, they have their celebrate their community, their communion, their fellowship. That's true, but how come that they are able to experience their communion, their fellowship in God, in Christ? You know, how is it possible? It's another miracle. So the miracle goes one step behind, further. You know. Okay, some more comments on this. Yes.
The thing that goes through my mind when I hear you talk is I think you get to a place when everything is useless, and you end up, you get to the point where you realize that all you have is your faith.
Yes.
And when you hit that spot, the thing that at least my experience was, I said it to someone. In fact, it says, "I got to lift up my head and shout. There's going to be a great day."
Yes.
I think that's when you get down to the pits. Mm-hmm. All this stuff is coming in on you. All of a sudden, then it's all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that was a release. And I don't know if the Brazilians, this would apply to the Brazilians with their joyfulness and all of their poverty and everything.
Well, one, excuse me.
The way you talk, they seem to have a fire going.
Yes, they do. They do. One of the great Brazilian exegetes, biblical interpreters, is Carlos Meesters. He's a Dutchman in origin, but has been in Brazil for 20 and more years. He's one of the leading Old Testament interpreters, and he is such a nice fellow, such a calm and humble person, you know. As I have met many of them. And when he comes to that point to talk about this, he said, well, I read in the book of Proverbs 15:15, exactly, that's Proverbs 15, verse 15, there's a beautiful little line which says, to the person who has dreary eyes, who has his eyes clouded, everything is clouded. The reality is all dreary and misty and without sunshine, you know? I put more words into it. The line is very short. You have to look it up. Proverbs 15:15. And to another fellow who has an open mind and a joyful heart, the world is bright. How is that possible? It's a way of looking at things, of what glasses or what eyes you have at your disposal to look at things, to see the marvels of God, the miracles. And we are, we Germans at least, we are in that position to see the bleak things only. The richer we got after the war, the more we went into this pit, seeing all the time the bleak things and the dreary and the dangerous things. And I have the impression that this is increasing in Germany. I don't want to talk about the United States, because I don't have so much experience of your communities and societies, but I have told you before that in Germany the lamenting kind is going on and on and on and is gaining force. You know, the dreary laments which have no foundation in joy, in liberation, in hope, in joy and in praise, you know. Could we leave that point, or you want to make some?
I just want to say, if you want to meet a friend, you have to be a friend.
That's similar. That's that's a good comparison, I think. Yes. Could we move on to our other point, which is very difficult? Friends and enemies now. In the midst of all this lamenting and praising in the Bible and in Brazil, we always come across the fact that the biblical psalmist as well as the Brazilian psalmist of our days, they oppose somebody. And what about that? I told you before, in the Bible, it's sometimes so bad to our feeling that enemies are denounced, even condemned. Starting in Psalm 5 and going through all the Psalter, you have many, many Psalms where enemies are playing, evil mongers, playing a great role, and they are being opposed. Even the wishes formulated to annihilate them, I guess that's the word. Annihilate is Portuguese. So sometimes I'm mixing some Portuguese in just to keep you aware of of your beautiful English language and seeing how I'm sort of torturing it, you know, and and making you feel good that you don't do it. But it's unconscious, you see. I have two foreign languages in my brains, and sometimes they get mixed up. I can't help it. Annihilation. Psalm 109 is the worst example of that. You also may look it up. There's a long, long cascade of denunciations and even curses against the one who is doing evil to me, the sufferer, you know. I bet that Psalm 109 never or almost never is used in Christian communities, you know, fearing this kind of hostility against the other one. And people always argue this is not possible to reconcile with Christ, with the Sermon of the Mount. You shall love your enemy, you know. Or with other sayings in the Gospels and so on. Well, there is truth to it, but Jesus denounced the Pharisees as well. In very harsh words, Matthew 22:23. So, what about this problem? Have you come across this problem that the Psalms are sort of spoiled for Christian use? I want to put it really... in sharp words, in hard words. The Psalms, some people, some Christian things, the Psalms are spoiled for Christian use because they denounce and curse enemies. What about that? And here we have all the beautiful Brazilian poetry of the poor with their confidence and with their lamentation, with their concreteness, which we talked about, and with their praise. You know, beautiful hymns, and all of a sudden, but the oppressors, those who are against you, those who are persecuting us, they may be silenced, they may be hit hard by God, and all sorts of wishes like this also occur in the Brazilian psalm poetry. What do you make of that? Do you have a solution for this problem? After all what we said before, perhaps in these last three sessions, this problem was touched upon occasionally on the margin. Perhaps you might have some ideas how we can go about it, thinking and resolving this problem. I haven't read any denunciations of enemies in the Psalms which you composed. I don't remember to have read stark words against the evil as such, you know, the evil which is permeating human society. It may well be one of the basic issues of our Christian life, this problem of how to deal with enemies. Do you want me to say a word about friends before in the Psalms? The friends are there too. I told you friends and enemies today. Friends are there too. But not more the implicit way. I told you that I visualize the Psalms of the Old Testament being used in a worship service for the suffering person, and there are bystanders and participants who worship with him or her and who support this person, keep him up. And they, when he, the sufferer and the patient, quotes the psalm, which he has to quote, they are probably giving their comments, or they support him like the choir supports the individual singer, you know, when he vocalizes or formulates the concerns of all of them. I also in your spirituals, the I of the individual singer comes up and stands out from the choir every now and then, and the choir is there to support the voice, the individual voice. So this means for me always that in reality there is no isolated individual singing, but there's always the group around. And this I see also in the Old Testament Psalms. They are supported, these individual voices of the sufferer, of the patients, of the sick people, of those who are unfortunate enough to fall in one pit after the other in their lives. I recently read a book by Moroccan analphabet, titled The Life is Full of Pitfalls. And he simply tells his story, you know, and as being tossed around and unfortunate and encountering bad circumstances, and he recovers, you know. Please. Yes. Please do.
When I think of the enemies, or you know, the oppressors, or the people, the enemies, I don't so much think of it in terms of, or you know, being against the enemies or being hard on the enemies. I don't think of it so much in terms of my outside circumstances, you know, like the guys on the other side of mm-hmm. war or whatever. I think of it in terms of any force, kind of like thinking the forces of good, the forces of evil. Mm-hmm. And any force that in some way hinders my path toward feeling that oneness with God, or my, towards feeling that glory and praise and honor mm-hmm. toward God. Anything that might get in my way, it could be just you know, wanting to be tempted by mm-hmm. something that I shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. You know, that to me is the force of evil. That is the enemy. And I can still be singing praises and glory if there's terrible things happening around me. If I, in fact, am still feeling the presence of God. The only thing that is truly the enemy mm-hmm. and that you really do want to come hard down on, and that God himself can come hard down on, is something that would keep me from feeling that mm-hmm. connection. So that's how I reconcile, you know, the yes. you know, glory and honoring God, praising God, even mm-hmm. if you're in the midst of war, mm-hmm. or how people can do that.
Yes.
And still also feel real clear that those psalms that, you know, come down hard on the oppressor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would it mean, do I understand you right, when I say that you would prefer to keep the forces of evil impersonal? Sort of being in all of us, you know, yeah. Affecting
each
all of us.
Each of us has our own yes. war going on, mm-hmm. our own battle. And it's those forces, you can call it, some people like to call it the devil.
And not personalize and say, you are, you know, we are standing up against the one who did wrong or something like that.
You personal. Can love your enemy. If, mm-hmm. yes. if someone comes up at you with a
yes.
knife,
yes.
And, you know, in the alley, and, you know, yes. you can love that person.
Yes. Jerry.
But isn't it important to, on the path towards some kind of possible reconciliation, even if the reconciliation is only possible because of God's intervention, is to name the enemy and to name the emotion that I feel when I'm in the presence of my enemy. And there are many different emotions, it seems to me, with that. And it seems like part of the Christian problem is that we have a great deal of difficulty acknowledging our emotions about the enemy and how we're threatened by and how we're angry with this force, which does take on a personality. And until we do that, how can we begin to really be open to move towards some kind of a confrontation or resolution with our enemy? The danger, it seems to me, is that we lock that person into being an enemy and not make room for some kind of. Mm-hmm.
I'm very glad about these two comments. What do you think?
One thing that comes to my mind is seems like we, just in general, this topic makes you think we have trouble talking about judgment of God these days, I think. Mm-hmm. That especially with the our good emphasis on inclusiveness, but we sometimes think, well, inclusiveness only means embracing, always recognizing that sometimes there has to be death in order for inclusion to happen, mm-hmm. and that there's no salvation without judgment. And that all comes together in the cross. Mm-hmm. The cross shows that there has to be judgment mm-hmm. in order for there to be salvation, and that God has to judge evil. He has to punish evil. He has to destroy mm-hmm. evil in order for there to be salvation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But how that...
Yeah. Ivor?
I think the presence of these things in the Bible, it's like Doug Peterson's devotion on Obadiah the other morning. He says, it's there in the Bible. If it has no other value, it's there. It's a humble sort of thing. And the Lamentations, they are there and sort of give permission to we who have had difficulty confronting God with His injustice as we perceive it. The imprecatory ones, the name the enemy, are even more difficult, but still they're there, and they sort of give a permission to do that. And maybe one of the closest things to it, corporately at least, is the naming of South Africa. It's probably a naming of apartheid, but it gives us permission to name South Africa. The church's attempt to call that a status confessionis, it's the status of a confession, that is evil and that is the enemy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, they are difficult to deal with, but they're there and they give us permission mm-hmm. to do that.
Mm-hmm. Did I see another? Just a second, please. Or do you want to refer directly to him?
No, go ahead.
Please.
This is off on a little different tangent, but when you're talking about the enemy, I was thinking about Jesus' confront Peter when Peter didn't want him to go back to Jerusalem. And he said, get away from me, Satan, or something yes. like that. That the enemy can appear within people we love and care for, so that it isn't a total personality or a total entity, but can be come through pieces of things that you also love.
Jerry?
As Ivor was talking, and as we've been talking, the psalm that I think is about this naming of the enemy that troubles me the most is the one that, what number is it? By the waters of Babylon we sat down and wept.
137.
137. Mm-hmm. Because I think that has the darkest conclusion of any
yes.
psalm. Would that you would bash the heads of
the
children of these people.
Yes.
Of the children of Babylon. Mm-hmm. And that, it seems to me, is almost hopelessly locked in a deepest kind of hatred and feeling of being oppression. And mm-hmm. maybe we bring some of that fruit on ourselves if we mm-hmm. would look at that in the light of South Africa. Or
mm-hmm. Yes.
That bothers me, too, when I read in the Old Testament that Samson killed 50,000 with the jawbone of an ass. I say to myself, those men had wives and children too. It kind of bothers me that a small force with God's help can slay 15,000 Philistines, and. So I wonder if we are entitled to use those as examples and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. name specific enemies, or should we do, as Julie said, identify only those things which prevent us from moving along our path and mm-hmm. not get too specific.
Yes.
I don't
yes.
know.
Well, I have heard now a good deal of your thinking, and it's fascinating to me how much you have gone into this problem. I think it's a problem. Let me start to respond a little to what I heard, and then you may come back on me, you know, or respond to my statements again. First of all, I think that the simple fact, either that things are in the Bible, are no license yet to use the same patterns. I know what you mean. You don't mean to say that, but we have to. That's my very strong opinion. We have to be responsible for our own faith in our times. And we cannot simply repeat any other expression or practice of faith from our forebears or from other people like Latin American people or Old Testament people or New Testament people. We have to also to apply a certain amount of what I would call criticism of faith, you know. And see what we in our situations can do. I only look at Old Testament, New Testament texts always as being inspiring forces of faith, but we have to take a stand on our own, in our time. And this, as I said many times before, our times do not coincide with any other times or situations. So we have to take a stand in our time. And on this, along this line, I would go ahead and think, reflect upon what, in general, is called the brutality of the Old Testament God and the Old Testament people. These big battles and these annihilations of enemies and many other things, which we not simply can, how would you say, endorse for us. We have to be careful, though, to understand what is going on in the Bible. When we talk about holy war, did you heard this expression ever? Holy war in the Bible, when Israel is marching into the land and clearing off everybody, you know, men, wife, children, and animals have to be condemned to death and handed over to Yahweh as cherem, that's the Hebrew word, as cherem, as banned good, you know. 1 Samuel 15 was mentioned implicitly by Esther, little dove, the other day when she was talking to the children. Saul, who did not ban everything and was punished for it, you know, because his obligation was to ban everything, to kill off everything. Well, we have to know what is behind these stories. I think there are legends about a warfare which did not take place in these terms, but they are theological expositions of what should have been taken. Also, the annihilation of annihilation of all the people who lived in Canaan. You know, in Exodus 34, before the commandments are repeated, you have the command: go and destroy everything which is there, and kill them off, and wipe them off the land, in order that you can take over the land. There is a theological concept behind it, which is not historical, you know. Because Judges 1 tells us quite frankly that the Israelites did not kill off everybody. There were more cities and more tribes left, actually, in historical terms. But anyway, the theological concept was the land needs to be cleared from all foreign influence. This is a late concept. And Israel has to take over and be a new people in a new land, in a pure land. And the idea of purity is behind it and expresses itself in these terrible terms of annihilation of whole peoples. So you have to look into the matters, what you're reading, you know. Anyway, what remains is a disturbing fact that Israel was living in these confrontations with other people. And this is, for the time, for the ancient time, is quite understandable. Israel in its heart still believed there is our people and there is our God and there are other peoples and other gods and they are fighting and contesting each other and the conflict is natural and is God-willed. In Micah 2 you have a verse, Israel, we believe in our God and the others believe in other gods, you know. And so the war is programmed, you know, the war between, even the divine war. But when Christ came and created a universal church, a global church, our spiritual ground is now different. We are no longer particular, limited in our faith to one people. Although we always fall into this temptation and say God is a German God, God is a Brazilian God, God is a United States citizen, you know, or president or something like that. We are very much inclined to do so, but our theology, our spiritual heritage, which we inherited from Jesus onward, is quite different. And from Paul onward, it's global, including everybody. This puts us on a new basis. We can no longer take particularism, nationalism, chauvinism, group interests, or whatever, what have you, as the basis of our theological and faith thinking. So that makes a difference. I think with the coming of Christianity, there is a breaking down of all these barriers, and there is this outlook, even if the reality is still so far from expressing it. There is an outlook, at least, on a humanity which is unified under one God, and which considers itself and every single human being, whatever race or group or class or nation or what have you he or she may belong to, considers as brothers and sisters. Here's a new foundation for our faith. I agree with that. And then things become different. Suffice it. Still, let me make one more point. I think what I heard before is very, very important, what Jerry and you said, and I like to put it together. Let me tell you that I heard at the Matins one morning, I heard the opinion or the statement of this Zen Buddhist, you know, who was... I liked it, and it gave me something to think about. He was talking about the 12-year-old girl abused and who killed herself, and he said something to the effect, being or the spirit or the everything, the good power was in the girl, and it was or in the murderer, in the abuser. There's certainly something true about it, but Buddhists have their way of saying that. I'm not so familiar with Buddhist thinking, but I suspect that our Christian way would be slightly different. Would you agree that this is a very important thing to depersonalize, like you said, depersonalize the evil force and say, well, the evil is here and there, Satan. You use the image of Satan, which is a late Old Testament image, very late one. Well, the evil permeates humanity. It's everywhere. It's in me. Never forget that. But does this relieve us of the responsibility, of our responsibility to name in certain instances the wrongdoer? Somebody said there is no salvation without judgment. This is my problem. Isn't there a point where we have to say, I am guilty of this, of this or that. I have done wrong. Isn't there a point where we have to say, you are wrong. You did something wrong. You, my friend. And isn't there a point in our history where we have to urgently seek the causes of present-day world evils? And I consider, coming from Latin America, I consider hunger, starvation of mass, of great and groups of people as the world evil number one. Disease and hunger and all these things which result from this awful distribution of goods on this globe, you know. Isn't there a point where we have to say to ourselves, we are guilty of it, or somebody, we have to identify the forces. If we don't do so, we have no chance to ever find a way out of this dilemma. That's my question.
Identifying it doesn't really change it, though. We know that the multinational corporation, the interlocking directorate, is probably the biggest one, the most powerful, where the money is most concentrated, and many of us work for those companies, use their products, and indirectly we're keeping it alive by buying Bayer aspirin or reading Newsweek or whatever.
Yes.
So how, knowing it's one thing, but doing about it is another thing. Just take Ethiopia as a case in point, when they shipped all the food over there and it never got to the people. There's a lot of other things involved in distributing our wealth among.
Yes.
I think that's part of the contraries we're talking about. The book, The People of the Lie, does a good analysis of that in the last third of that book, where it talks about the tragedy in Vietnam. And it's easy to identify William Calley as the one who did it. But as soon as you do that, you got to identify the silence of his superiors. And as soon as you do that, you got to bring it back to the Pentagon. And as soon as you do that, back to the president.
Yes,
and as soon as you do that, back to me.
Back to us.
Mm-hmm. And if you can't name the enemy, you may never be able to name yourself either as a participant.
Yes, yes.
And so it's a contrary. I've never prayed to bash the heads of anybody in all of my ministry. I don't think I've done that. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a pacifist.
Yes.
And yet, nevertheless, the necessity to identify, and rather specifically the enemy, helps me to identify myself as well as a participant in the evil system.
That's about the way I'm looking at these things. And I believe that knowing and doing about it are two very separate things, you know. But in Latin America, they always tell you, when you start, when we start arguing like this, you have to begin with knowing and admitting.
I wonder if we shouldn't really begin by looking at ourselves. As Christians, what you said a moment ago about Christ brought a new basis, and it was explained by Paul. For 1900 years or more, most wars have been religious wars, and many, many of them have been Christians against Christians. And our failure over 1900 years to understand what Jesus and Paul was talking about makes us the culprit.
Yes.
And I think if we look at ourselves before we go out and try to pin something on someone else.
Yes.
I don't disagree with identifying the enemy. But if I'm really sensitive, I better start identifying myself.
Mm-hmm. But this goes together, as I heard from you before. I think at least that, taking Psalms 137 as a backdrop, it seems to be unaware of this complexity of taking part. And sometimes in history, possibly, I wouldn't judge it. I wouldn't judge Psalm 137 as always totally wrong. Sometimes in history it may occur that a downtrodden people comes to this bitterness and to this total hatred, which says, "Well, smash the children of the others." Mm-hmm. But what I would condemn if we would repeat that, starting from this new foundation of Christ. I think we cannot repeat any such thing. Condemning the enemy and leaving us out of our own responsibility. So what is resting for me is the insight. I'm part of systems. I'm partly responsible. I'm a German. And I grew up in the war, and I was, with my young years of 10 years, I entered the Hitler Youth and was fascinated by this ideology, participated against the will of my father. I mentioned my father as an atheist, but he had a better sense than I of human affairs. He was a worker, a miner. And he said, Hitler is a criminal to me when I was a boy. And I didn't believe him. I liked the uniform. I liked to march. I liked to sing. I liked to condemn enemies. In 2 years, I was with this bunch of criminals, you know, from 10 to 12. And I remember very well when the Battle of Stalingrad was waged in 42 or something. And our leader, I advanced even. I had already this little red-white cord here to be a leader of 10, you know. A leader of 10. And I chastised the boys when they went to church on Sundays, and I had to take care that we had to go and march to our youth, Hitler Youth occasion, you know. That was me. So I was part of that system. And the same way, I feel part of our economic structure today, using all the amenities, or how do you say amenities, of life and industry and technology, I come down to Brazil, and here I am. I was there last April for 4 weeks again. Here I am as the representative of the affluent society in the north, you know. Here I am. And I know that, and they know that I'm part of this, you know, and I know it. And still I have to make decisions about where the evil is and how to amend to better the situation. Otherwise I feel forlorn, you know. That's the way I feel. I am part of the system, of the oppressive system. Yes.
I feel the value and importance of naming the enemy is in keeping with what Dad said. You know, we need to look at ourselves first, but to name the enemy is for us to know what we don't want to be.
Yes.
Say, that is what, I know what is good. I do not want to be like that, so I can start from me, and just spread out, you know. Mm-hmm. And if all of us, if all of us individuals take that responsibility on ourselves to use the naming of the enemy as a way of making sure that we don't... And I don't mean that you... I mean, we struggle with this too. You know, we're in a modern society. There's so many evil things out there. You have to use your common sense to do it. You can't go out and you need toothpaste. You know, maybe there's... I mean, if there are some little things you can do, you can't go, you know, if it's not going to involve killing somebody immediately, then okay, you know. It's kind of like the food chain, you know. They're talking about the lowest food chain. You know, if we got right down to it, you couldn't eat anything because it would involve killing plants, which is, you know. But you kind of use your common sense and do what you can. Do the least possible wrong. And still just as an individual...
And foment knowledge, I think. That's about, at the moment, consciousness. Paulo Freire calls it consciousness. Consciousness of the reality as it is, you know, consciousness. He said that's already a power, a transforming power. I recommend Paulo Freire, Pedagogics of the Oppressed is the title. And he says we have to liberate not only the poor, but also the rich, you know. And we are part of them, and he knows about this dichotomy, you know, and this this ambivalence in us, you know. And he is a very, very clear theological thinker. Pedagogia, or pedagogics better, I guess it has, yeah, it's available in English also. Pedagogics of the oppressed. I respect him highly, as many of these theologians. We have to liberate the poor. We have to be on the side of the poor, but we must not need the rich, the oppressed. They have to be liberated also. They are poor creatures. Mm-hmm. And do you remember the prayer of Helder Kammerer, which was read in one of the evening vespers? God certainly is the God of the poor. Which poor? The poor, physical poor, mm-hmm, and the spiritual poor. And the poor, God of the poorest of the poor, the rich poor. Now, let's close this with our hymn. The foundation of everything is, nevertheless, the hymn, the praise, Cantai au Senhor. Cantai au Senhor, un cantico novo, cantai au Senhor. Un cantico novo, cantai au Senhor. Un cantico novo, cantai au Senhor. Cantai au Senhor. Once more? Or do you want to stop? Cantai au Senhor, un cantico novo, cantai au Senhor. Un cantico novo, cantai au Senhor. Un cantico novo, cantai au Senhor. Cantai au Senhor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.